Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, January 19, 2016. The UN says it needs more than $1 billion to help millions of South Sudanese still affected by the conflict.
About 3.9 million people, according to the IPC, nearly one in every three people in South Sudan were severely food insecure as of September 2015, including some 30,000 people who were facing catastrophic food insecurity.
And South Sudan introduces bills that would monitor and restrict the activities of non-governmental organizations.
The Relief and Rehabilitation Commission is the authority to manage, register, and then do business with the NGOs. There will be some registrar appointed by the RRC who will be able to register all the NGOs operating in South Sudan under the NGO bill.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. United Nations aid agencies and the government of South Sudan are asking for more than $1 billion to continue providing humanitarian aid to more than 5 million people still affected by the two-year-long conflict. The UN's humanitarian coordinator for South Sudan made the appeal while launching a humanitarian response plan for 2016. From Juba, Mungume Debs Rakarinj files this report for VOA.
Speaking at the launch of the appeal in Juba today, South Sudan's UN humanitarian coordinator, Eugene Owusu, said the war has brought immense suffering to millions of people in the country. He says the money will be used to provide life-saving assistance such as food, water and health care to people across the country. He says one in every five people in South Sudan have been forced to flee their homes since the conflict began. That is more than 2 million people. He says nearly 1.7 million people have been internally displaced, while more than 640,000 others have fled neighboring countries such as Uganda, Kenya and Ethiopia. Also says providing aid to all these people is a daunting task.
We do know that hunger and malnutrition have become widespread in this country, and now hunger and malnutrition are present in locations that were previously considered stable. About 3.9 million people, according to the IPC, nearly one in every three people in South Sudan were severely food insecure as of September 2015, including some 30,000 people who were facing catastrophic food insecurity.
Also says the conflict has been especially brutal on young children. More than 680,000 children under the age of five are believed to be acutely malnourished. Last year, humanitarian agencies delivered aid to more than 4.4 million South Sudanese, including treatment for 140 malnourished children. As a result of war, Owusu says, hunger has reached places that were previously food secure because people are unable to farm their gardens.
The plan that we have before us today is strictly prioritized, and it focuses on responding to the most urgent and life-saving needs in South Sudan, while helping to ensure that communities are protected, capable, and prepared to cope with significant threats.
Besides food, also says the money will be used to help children go back to school. Andrew Seto, IDPs. Speaking on behalf of the Armed Opposition, Relief Operations Director Gatwich Peter Kulang says the SPLM-IO is aware of the suffering the war has inflicted on the population.
We are concerned by appalling figures that nearly one in every three schools in South Sudan has been destroyed, damaged, occupied or closed, impacting on the education of more than 900,000 children.
Also says the warring parties must ensure that humanitarian workers have access to people in need of assistance. He says humanitarian workers have had to suspend operations or withdraw their staff from some areas for their own safety. But Professor Lokuleng Lole Timayo, the head of South Sudan's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, says aid workers will be much safer now that a peace accord has been signed.
We want peace to succeed. Once that succeeds, then those areas of insecurity will automatically disappear. Because then there will be no fighting. Most of these people who died in this, either they have died in crossfire or attacks, or they are involved in areas where the two armies fight.
The UN says 43 aid workers have died while on duty since fighting broke out in South Sudan in late 2013. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Roakarinj in Juba.
South Sudan's Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila yesterday reintroduced a bill in Parliament aimed at regulating the operations of non-governmental organizations across the country. Wanawila also reintroduced the Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission Bill, which requires non-governmental organizations to register with the government and set up a committee that would monitor their activities. Philip Thornalew reports for VOA from Juba.
In May last year, South Sudanese lawmakers passed the bill regulating and monitoring the work of NGOs, but it was not signed into law by President Salva Kiir. No explanation was offered as to why the bill was not signed, but there was a large backlog of bills last year to be signed by the president. Aid agencies and human rights organizations widely criticized the legislation, saying it contained a number of problematic provisions, including a requirement that no more than one-fifth of organization staff may be foreigners. The president's objection to the bill were never made public. Wanawila says this year's bill on regulating NGOs has been improved and that the other bill regarding NGOs was introduced separately, even though the substance of the bills are related.
These two bills complement one another because the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission is the authority that will be able to manage, register, and then do business with the NGOs. Now, there will be a registrar appointed by the RRC who will be able to register all the NGOs operating in South Sudan under the NGO bill.
Wanawila says the government is not trying to stifle the operations of humanitarian organizations in the country.
But there is no country where you have a free lunch to go and do business as you want. We also have our reservation as government about the NGOs, because sometimes they concentrate doing the same thing in the same area. And when you tell them to diversify their services, like the health services, they say no. You cannot operate in a country under your own condition.
It says one of the bill requires each NGO to employ at least 80% of South Sudanese nationals at all levels of management. At least 2 million South Sudanese affected by the conflict rely on NGOs for food, health services, and education. When asked why the government cannot wait for the full implementation of the peace agreement before presenting the NGOs' bills, Wanawila replied that there is no provision in the agreement that restricts the normal operations of the government.
You don't hold the function of the nation wholly to wait for a particular thing, unless that function has been mentioned specifically in the agreement. We know that there are laws that will be reviewed, even by the National Constitution Review Committee, and they are mentioned in the agreement. But it does not mean that everything should come to stand still until the government is formed.
The bill was referred to Parliament's Legal Committee and will be debated in Parliament next week. The NGO Forum, a body comprised of various local and international non-governmental organizations, declined to comment on this story, citing lack of knowledge about the bill's contents. For VOA News, I'm Peloton Leo in Juba.
A six-year-old boy was killed and a woman and another boy were seriously injured after a grenade exploded in Tombora County of Budue State this morning. Gift Friday has the story for VOA from Juba.
Juma Memori, the father of the two children, says he was not at home when the incident happened.
I was going to my farm in Nadaruma when my wife called me and said a bomb has exploded and hit the children and they have been brought to the hospital. One of the children has just died.
Memori says his older son suffered a broken leg and had two toes blown off in the explosion, and the other woman suffered a back injury. Memori says his children were sent by their mother to be with their uncle, who lives in Tombora's Youngstar residential area. A local government inspector in Tombora County, Thomas Frederick, says the accident happened at around 8 a.m.
Two children were searching for potatoes, digging. From there, they hit the explosive ordnance. Then it exploded and injured them seriously. At coma point, they took them to the hospital. I was able to see them. They were really in serious situation. The condition was not suspecting even to live again after, but maybe by the help of God, they might survive.
Memori says his children were not trying to harvest sweet potatoes in the nearby garden when the mine exploded. He says the mine struck the children in an open area where they normally play. Frederick says an exploded ordnance remains a big problem in the area. He says this is the second time a landmine has exploded there. In late December, another mine exploded in Tombora, but no casualties were reported. He says a demining group working in Tombora only cleared 1 square kilometer of an exploded ordnance in the area. Frederick blames local chiefs for failing to identify what he calls unsecured areas in the county. He says the Tombora County authorities will educate citizens about the dangers caused by landmines and other unexploded ordnance.
Now we shall try to explain to them so that the children should not move anywhere, and even burning bushes anywhere, because this is where sometimes these ordnances explodes and then it injures people.
Thomas says if residents see anything suspicious, they should immediately report it to the authorities. He is appealing to the mining agencies to return to Tombora to clear the area of all landmines. Tombora County was the scene of many battles in the 1990s during the war between the then SPLA rebels and the Sudanese army. Gift Friday for VOA News, Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The largest non-oil investor in South Sudan plans to close down. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how old is your oldest relative? What is their health secret?
One of my oldest relative is 112 years, and the secret of that, because he's eating the national food. He don't drink, he don't smoke, and he exercise a sport.
My oldest relative is my grandma. She's almost like 70-something. And her health secret is she keep it traditional with the food, especially. Like, she always gets the traditional food, and that's what she likes, like the asida and the greens.
That will be, I think, 95. And their secret was the diet. They ate a lot of vegetables and less of meat.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about Ebola antibodies. Although the Ebola epidemic in West Africa is essentially over, except for some sporadic individual cases, research to find a vaccine or cure continues. The latest research shows success in using antibodies to fight Ebola infections in mice. The study was done by researchers at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York and the U.S. Medical Institute of Infectious Diseases. They engineered antibodies in to combat the two deadly strains of Ebola, the Zaire and Sudan strains. Dr. Jonathan Lai is the co-leader of the study and associate professor of medicine at Einstein College from New York. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the antibody research on Ebola.
Antibodies are the workhorse of the immune system. What happens is when you or anybody else gets an infection, the body produces antibodies as a way of trying to fight off the infection. So they're protein molecules that bind to the virus and either prevent the virus from infecting new cells or help clear the virus from the body. The problem with Ebola is that the virus, once it infects a host, is able to replicate very rapidly to the point where it can very quickly overtake the immune system so that the body can't produce these types of antibodies fast enough. So the idea behind antibody therapy is to give the body a chance to get a leg up on the infection by giving additional antibody.
Why focus on those two particular strains of the Ebola virus?
Really two reasons. The first reason is because if you look at historical outbreaks from 1976 to 2012, and I don't include the 2014 and 2015 epidemic because the numbers still are being worked out in terms of the number of cases, but from 1976 to 2012 at least, the Zaire species and the Sudan species are responsible for 95% of Ebola-related deaths. In fact, before the 2014 epidemic, the largest outbreak of any Ebola virus species was actually caused by Sudan in the year 2000. So, number one, we felt that something that at least covered those two species would be a significant advance. The second reason is because those two species on the evolutionary scale are actually the furthest away from one another in terms of the properties and the amino acid alignment sequences of the glycoprotein. So we felt that if we could really bridge those two different distant species, that would be also a very good first step to be able to accomplish.
Is there a simple way to explain how you tweaked the antibodies to make them recognize and kill the Ebola virus?
Sure. So we started with two different antibodies, one that was specific for the Zaire species and one that was specific for the Sudan species. What we did was basically link the Zaire antibody with the Sudan antibody to create a two-in-one combination Zaire-Sudan antibody.
So you did this work in mice, is that correct?
Once we had produced the antibodies, we shipped them off to our collaborator, John Dye, who's at the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRID. And he works in a high containment facility, a biosafety level 4 facility, which is required for these types of pathogens. And he and his team tested the efficacy in mice.
And the outcome?
In one experiment, he took mice and challenged them with the Zaire species of the virus and then provided the combined antibody. And in a separate experiment, he took a separate batch of mice and challenged them with the Sudan Ebola virus and then provided them with the same antibody. And what he found in both cases is that he was able to observe 100% protection. In other words, none of the mice died from the Ebola virus species in either case, whereas the control groups that did not receive the antibody treatment in both groups had all died by the 10th day.
So what do you have to do next to show that this might work in humans?
Typically, therapeutics in the filovirus field are characterized first in mice, but then they have to go to some larger animals. So guinea pig models might be the next thing. And the large animal studies in non-human primates are really important to try to figure out if things would be effective in humans. And many therapeutics that do look good in mice aren't as effective in non-human primates. So I think it's just about doing the experiments to try to figure that out. For our lab specifically, it may be that the best broad therapeutic actually comprises a cocktail of monoclonal antibodies. In our case, the current thing that we've tested is really only a single monoclonal antibody. So for our lab, the next task is really to see what other types of antibodies we can create with these types of features, whether we can improve the activity, and then whether we can mix different engineered antibodies with the one that we've already created to try to produce an effective therapeutic cocktail that's broad for all the Ebola viruses.
Dr. Jonathan Lay is an associate professor of medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine from New York. He spoke to viewers Joe DiCapua. A major employer in South Sudan says the country's high inflation rate is forcing the company to close its doors. SINBO reports from Washington. Many families who depend on the company will suffer.
Saab Miller, South Sudan's only brewery, is calling it quits after spending 5 years and investing millions of dollars in South Sudan since 2009. Bloomberg and other media outlets say the London-based brewery plans to cut more than 176 jobs in Juba by the end of March. disappointing many beer drinkers but also reducing options for a country desperate to diversify its economy. David Chan-Thiang, Director of Economics at the National Bureau of Statistics, says as a result of the shortage of hard currency in the country, prices for imports have also risen. That trend, according to Chan, is making it difficult for companies to thrive in South Sudan.
Because if somebody used to pay $100,000 from the clearing of the goods from the border of South Sudan, especially namely, now it's $300,000. So people are running away from bringing goods to this country. So it had for people who are looking for more investment in South Sudan.
Paul Gabriel, an East Africa analyst at Control Risk, a London-based risk consultancy firm, says Saab Miller's decision to vacate the country could be a result of the unstable political climate that has consumed South Sudan for the past 2 years. He says just before South Sudan's independence, many companies were eager to invest in the country's untapped market, even though the risk for running operations on the ground were fairly high. The violence that broke out in late 2013 added to the concerns of many potential investors.
The insecurity, of course, also meant that companies that were potentially looking at coming into South Sudan haven't really done so, and so the country is still very much reliant on the oil industry, which with the current oil prices, of course, is a big concern.
The price of oil has dropped from around $100 a barrel at its high point to under $30 a barrel just last week, which means countries like South Sudan are struggling to pay their bills. Not many companies operating in South Sudan have access to foreign currency, according to Chan. He says even the banks themselves have difficulty securing foreign money.
For example, now in such a situation that we are in, by now all these companies are actually closed because they always look for hard currency from the central bank. So the hard currency from the central bank are almost hard for other companies to get access to this. So all these companies are actually die out. Or they have the difficulties of bringing goods or fuel from the foreign countries because they don't have access to what? To the foreign currencies.
Gabriel says he can think of only one industry that is still interested in investing in South Sudan.
The only other investors that we have seen looking at South Sudan were mining companies, mainly because some of the big mining reserves are in the southern part of the country, which hasn't so much been affected by the civil war, at least initially. But in recent weeks, and indeed in recent months, the southern part of the country also has become more insecure, so even the mining companies have struggled.
The South Sudanese pound was devalued by 84% in December after the Bank of South Sudan got rid of its fixed exchange rate, ultimately adopting the black market's 18.5% rate. The inflation rate in December was over 109%, a 100% increase from the previous year's inflation rate. Economic analysts warned that the market would see a stark jump in prices following the decision to switch to the black market rate, but also say the market will eventually stabilize. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
Christians in Cameroon have started guarding of mosques and during prayer sessions, and Muslims are also guarding churches after 5 attacks on mosques by suspected Boko Haram fighters. The 5th mosque was attacked by a teenage female suicide bomber near the Central African nation's border with Nigeria on Monday. Boko Haram is now attacking not only churches, schools and markets, but also mosques, making Cameroonians more united to fight what they call a common enemy. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
This is a call to morning prayer in the central mosque at Mozogu, located on Cameroon's border with Nigeria. The faithful assemble while members of the local vigilante committee keep guard and make sure no stranger is given access. Among the vigilantes is 55-year-old Jacques Mabali, a Christian of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Cameroon. He says he responded to the call of his church's hierarchy to protect the Muslim faithful when they gather for their religious obligations. He says he is carrying out a social activity for the well-being of his country. he says it is his duty as a Christian to defend his country and aid suffering people and humanity, and adds that it is unfortunate Cameroon is suffering such violence. Ibrahim Mokhtar, a Muslim youth leader in Mozogu, says they too surround and secure churches because the insurgents have on several occasions attacked Christians.
En tant que fidèle, je fais la prière que Dieu nous protège dans cette histoire-là, et ça nous inquiète trop.
He says he is not only praying for God to save Cameroon from the killer group Boko Haram, but coming out to secure churches because Christians and Muslims are brothers and sisters. He says some of his family members are Christians and others like him are Muslims. He says they are not only praying ceaselessly but working hard to end terrorism. The Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram has been active in Cameroon for 3 years, looting, killing, burning schools, markets and churches. The vigilante groups were created to assist the government after Boko Haram began using female suicide bombers early last year. In December 2015, suspected members of Boko Haram, which said it was attacking Cameroon to create an Islamist state, started attacking mosques. Governor Mijiyawa Bakari of Far North Cameroon has congratulated Christians and Muslims for working together to protect the country from the terrorist group and urged others in the country to follow the example.
Nous l'avons vu et nous avons applaudi à deux mains cette mesure qui a consisté.
He says he visited areas in Mayochanaga on Cameroon's border with Nigeria, where Muslims took guard of churches, while Christians prayed and vice versa. He says that is one of the best things that is happening to assist Cameroon and Nigerian soldiers fighting the Boko Haram insurgency. He says it once more indicates how Cameroon is a land of legendary interreligious tolerance and that everybody seems to condemn the barbaric acts of Boko Haram. Cameroon believes the fighters have resorted to attacking mosques because their ability to strike has been drastically reduced following raids on Boko Haram strongholds by Cameroonian and Nigerian troops. Of Cameroon's 23.7 million people, 40% are Christians, 20% Muslims, and the rest hold indigenous beliefs. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That report by Kinzika brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Jain Gidam by Richard Babadu. Been listening to Richard Badagbo with that song Jain Gidam, I'm John Tanza in Washington. It's good to be back here after a one-month break. Thanks for listening. Join me again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Thank you.